Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments Podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, Managing Editor for Neurology Live. In this episode, we're going to do something that may be familiar to some of you who have been following the show for a while. To recap some of this year's American Academy of Neurology annual meeting, we're going to feature a number of people who we sat down with this week during the meeting. We spoke with a variety of clinicians about presentations and hot topics to highlight some exciting data from the annual meeting, as well as talk about some of the themes in areas of neurological care and the physician experience. So without further ado, let's dive in and hear what they had to say. Some of our conversation with Dr. Jennifer Frontera, a professor of neurology at NYU Langone Grossman School of Medicine, who we spoke to about our current understanding of COVID-19 and its neurological effects, as well as some of the long-term follow-up data that she presented at AAN on post-infection experiences and what we know about how the disease impacts people long-term. Here's Dr. Frontera with a little more.
I think the passionate part comes from the fact of what we really went through in the spring of 2020 in New York City. I'm a neurointensivist. I was a regular intensivist during that time, and we were really in the trenches. So, I'd like to think that part of our defense mechanism was sublimation across the board, because all of the residents attendings were very motivated to do something positive during this super stressful time. And so I talked a little bit about the prospective study that we did, which is a large study. It was, there's not that many prospective studies looking at acute COVID in hospitalized folks. So I think it's unique in that regard. But, we did look at everyone who was touched by a neurologist, diagnosed by a neurologist with a new disorder. I talked a little bit about what happens with those patients long term. So we followed them longitudinally at 6 and 12 months and did outcome batteries, et cetera. And during the acute phase, at least our population, only 14% were diagnosed with a new neurological event. But, you have to keep in mind, no one was going to the hospital during the first wave, right? They were staying home, probably dying at home. We didn't see strokes. We didn't see appendicitis. We didn't see the things you should be seeing at a regular basis, because people didn't want to come to the hospital. So by the time they came to the hospital, they were at death's door. They were not in any position to start talking to you about their anosmia or their headaches. They're just trying to breathe, okay? And so we did not get into some of these symptoms that might be very common. We were much more focused on, did you have a stroke? Did you have an intracranial hemorrhage? Did you have Guillain-Barré syndrome? Specific diagnoses. So I guess you could say that the severe diagnoses happened in about 14%. A much larger percent, I'm sure, had symptoms that are technically neurologic, like headache or whatever, but were more common and probably less severe in their impact. When we followed these patients longitudinally, and I will say 20 plus percent, 22% were intubated. So they're a pretty sick cohort. The patients that had a new neurological injury at 6 months did, as you might expect, they did worse than those who didn't. But then at 12 months, they were pretty similar. The neuro people caught up. In terms of trajectories, they still were a little bit worse, but not statistically significantly worse. And unfortunately, even if you didn't have a new neuro event, half of the patients had cognitive abnormalities on telephone MoCA testing. 87% tested abnormal on one of the metrics we looked at. So we looked at Barthel Index, we looked at modified Rankin, the telephone MoCA, and then some patient-related quality of life outcomes, like the NIH NeuroQoL for anxiety, depression, fatigue, and sleep. And so people were really 90% scoring abnormal at 12 months, 90% scored abnormal at 6 months. In the subset of patients that had testing both at 6 and 12 months, which was 174 patients, there was improvement in telephone MoCA scores by a point. But for telephone MoCA, that's a clinically significant amount of improvement. And anxiety scores also improved. So, I mean, there's some silver lining here. Some of these patients are getting better over time. And how much of that is related to secondary effects of COVID, like hypoxia or whatever, versus ongoing issues with post-acute sequela, I'm not sure. I will say that when we asked about symptoms, 50% of patients said they still had symptoms 12 months later. The top and we asked about all the symptoms from the WHO case report form. So it's also like shortness of breath, urinary problems, COVID toast. We asked about all of that. The number one thing was shortness of breath. That was the number one issue that people were still complaining of. But right behind that was headache and then brain fog. And like clinically, when you talk to people who see these patients as outpatients, the headache and brain fog are the things. There's some other, you know, things that are hard to nail down, like this internal vibration feeling, the tinnitus, vertigo, orthostasis types of problems that some folks have. But those were less common, a lot less common than the headache and brain fog complaints. But what's interesting is 20% of people said they had some cognitive problem, but 50% tested abnormal, right? So there's like some anosognosia. There's certain people that are like, I'm fine, and they're not fine. And that's a really interesting group of people. So, you know, and I don't know if some of the people, I have to look at the data more granularly, like how many of the people who said they weren't fine actually tested completely fine. Now, the MoCA, the telephone MoCA is not sensitive. I mean, I'm not going to say that it's the most sensitive thing. It's a screening thing. So, you know, still some people who say they have an issue but test okay on that may still have issues. And they may be very high functioning people who are noticing that they cognitively can't do the very high level work they normally do. And so that could be the case. But the fact that there's a chunk of people that are like, I'm fine, and they're definitely not fine on the most basic version of testing is concerning. So, you know, the squeaky wheel gets the oil, but guess what? There's probably a lot of problems that are going under the radar in some of these populations that are not as vociferous. And I will say what is concerning is when we looked at cognitive outcomes at 6 months, the people who had worse outcomes were the people with lower education levels. Even though you adjust for education when you score the MoCA, that was still a predictor of how you do on that test, but also black race and people with baseline disabilities tended to do worse. Significantly, there were sort of significant predictors of worse scores on the MoCA after adjusting for everything else. And this is a post-hospitalization cohort. So there are social determinants of health that are definitely in play. I am personally very concerned that some underserved populations that are not as vociferous or may not be the ones who are piping up as much are actually very severely affected and not getting any attention. So if you look at these surveys, and we did a survey too. Who is complaining of post-acute COVID? Young white women, okay? All right, so maybe there's an autoimmune mechanism at play, right? Women have more autoimmune diseases. That could be it. Or it could be that that's only a really small subsegment of who really is suffering with post-acute sequelae, and they don't get the press. The underserved populations, the undereducated populations are not getting the press, and yet they're really maybe more devastated than others. That's a huge concern, and I think we have to, like, somebody has to dig into that to a greater extent. But I will say that I think looking at social determinants of health is very, very much at the top of people's minds nowadays. So I think, like, the Recover Initiative has entire sections on social determinants. I think that particular project was just gigantic, 18,000 patients in the adult cohort alone, never mind peds, pregnancy, and autopsy and real-world data. I think they will pull out some of these issues in that particular study. So I just hope that the funding to support those populations that really need it in terms of therapeutics is there later on when we figure out what's happening.
Next, you're going to hear a bit of our conversation with Dr. Steven Krieger, a professor of neurology at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, who spoke a little bit about how the MS field is trending toward a more holistic view, focusing on maximizing brain reserve and maintaining patient quality of life, as well as some of the data he found intriguing from this year's meeting. Here's Dr. Krieger with his thoughts.
So yeah, if we go from modern and maybe a little bit esoteric with looking at activated microglia and things that we can't do in routine clinical practice, I think it's nice to end on a focus of things that we can do in our routine clinical practice that are being shown to make a difference. So my colleague Jim Simowski at Mount Sinai has worked with my other colleague, Dr. Alana Katzand, on looking at Mediterranean diet and how adherence to a Mediterranean diet, the MIND diet, correlated with disability measures on functional composite, correlated with patient-reported outcomes of disability, and even metrics of brain atrophy. And so here we're showing, and she showed with a cohort of around 600 patients, that better adherence to the MIND diet, a Mediterranean diet, had beneficial effects on measurable disability, patient-reported disability, and brain atrophy. And also just to make the point that this is something we can all do, we can all recommend a Mediterranean diet. It's not necessarily very expensive or very exclusive. It just really tries to get away from processed foods and to a much more natural way of eating. And we can even measure the brain atrophy the way Dr. Katzand and Simowski did it was with third ventricular width. So we don't even need fancy quantified MRI for that. You can just measure the third ventricle. So it's a very accessible way of gauging the impact of a very attainable intervention, Mediterranean diet. The other thing that was presented here from that same cohort, Simowski's cohort at Mount Sinai, was presented by one of my research collaborators, Tali Soritz, looking at depression. And you know, we focus on symptom management and quality of life in MS, but they hypothesized that the way depression behaves in MS is different from run-of-the-mill depression. They hypothesized that because of the inflammatory mechanisms that may cause MS depression, it could have a particular effect on anhedonia, loss of pleasure. And that's what they found using kind of a complex network analysis of various neuropsych tests. So it may not be the case that people with MS will endorse sadness, which I think for most clinicians is what we think is the main calling card of depression, but they may actually have lost a sense of pleasure, this anhedonic feeling, sapping people of agency. And it is hard to intervene there because it can be very self-perpetuating. And so they're looking at ways of trying to address that. The MIND diet, again, has been shown to have benefits on depression outcomes. So it's a way of kind of tying this whole piece together, at least coming out of our comprehensive care program at Mount Sinai. Yeah, I think our field in MS has really moved in this direction of not just highly effective medicines to prevent relapses and lesions, but also ways of trying to maximize brain reserve. That's what, you know, my colleague Jim Simowski is really focused on. It speaks directly to the way I look at multiple sclerosis with the notion of lesions in their various locations causing symptoms. But the extent to which brain health is maintained allows us to compensate for them. So in my topographical model, the notion there is however deep the pool of reserve is, helps to keep the disease under the surface compensated for. So I think the future in MS care is going to be not just optimal disease-modifying therapies, but all of these more holistic techniques to keep the tank full, keep reserve up, be positive brain-related, brain health-related behaviors that we can kind of help our patients to achieve. And I think that combination is what will ensure good outcomes in this disease.
Now we're going to jump into a bit of our conversation with Dr. Peter McAllister, the medical director and chief medical officer of the New England Center for Neurology and Headache, who spoke a little bit about the STEMTRA trial design in traumatic brain injury, as well as the state of regenerative medicine for neurological injury and disease. Dr. McAllister presented results from the STEMTRA trial at this year's annual meeting. Here's what he had to say.
I mean, having been a clinical researcher for nearly 25 years, this is one of the most exciting trials I've ever done. Moderate or severe traumatic brain injury is devastating to the individual, to the families, and even to society from a cost of care basis. there's no treatments at all right now. We can give a little botulinum neurotoxin to help with spasticity, but we've never improved function with that. So here in a phase 2 trial, it was only 61 patients, so there's further data to be collected, but everything, including dexterity, disability, motor, sensory, gait speed, everything from the clinician and the individual patient could tell what they were on, placebo or not. We saw big outcomes here. So this was terribly exciting. We also figured out among the 2.55 and 10 million stem cell doses, the 5 million was the sweet spot. So patients did considerably better in 5 than 2.5 or 10. So now going forward, we're going to work on a larger, double-blind, randomized, sham-controlled study using just that 5 million stem cell dose versus a sham. The whole concept of regenerative medicine is getting better and growing. So the idea that traumatic brain injury, stroke, brain hemorrhage, and then further afield, spinal cord injury, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's, ALS perhaps, regenerative medicine is just getting better and better. We're learning more. We're learning that adjuvants are needed with the stem cells. We're learning what type of stem cells are best, what populations benefit the most. Other countries such as Japan are ahead of us. Japan has actually revised its version of the FDA to allow regenerative trials through very, very quickly. And I hope our FDA someday catches up to that. But in the meantime, we'll continue to do large, big, double-blind trials to try to prove that this stem cell therapy, regenerative medicine, is here to stay.
Staying on the theme of data, we're going to hear a little bit from Dr. Kelly Knupp, a pediatric neurologist and epilepsy specialist at Colorado Children's Hospital, who some of you may remember from our recent special episode. This time, she sat down to talk to us about long-term use of fenfluramine in Lennox-Gastaut syndrome and shared a few clinical pearls about how she approaches titration of this therapy for patients now that it's approved and will be available later this year. Here's Dr. Knupp with her thoughts.
Well, I mean, I think anytime we're choosing a medication, we're always looking at, you know, risk for side effects, you know, what would side effects look like in this particular patient versus benefit of the medication. And honestly, you know, many of our medicines cause increased weight gain. And so, you know, while we worry about the decrease in appetite, for some of our patients, that may actually be a benefit for them to maintain their weight. So so I think that's something to take into account when you're thinking about this. In my own clinical practice, something that I do different with this medication that hasn't really been studied or discussed is normally when we titrate a medication, we go up every week or so to a bigger dose. And what I've learned in my experience with this medication is that sometimes it's really helpful to make an adjustment and then watch for 4 weeks before we make the next adjustment. And that's how the open label extension was designed. But a number of my patients actually saw ongoing improvement without over that 4 week period without us making an adjustment in their medication. And so I think perhaps we do need to more slowly titrate this medication up to see the full benefit of the medication. I don't think it's a delay in effect. I think it just takes time to see the full benefit of the dose adjustment that you've made. And so if we were making adjustments every week instead of every 4 weeks, you may actually overshoot the dose that you really, that the child really needs to be on. And so that's just a pearl that I've been doing in my own practice. And I feel that I have a number of patients that haven't maximized their dose and really have seen significant benefit because we've just been patient with it.
Keeping on the theme of relatively new approved therapies, we sat down with Dr. Bruce Cree, the clinical research director of the UCSF Multiple Sclerosis Center, to talk a little bit about inebilizumab, a newly approved therapy for NMOSD. We spoke to him about data he presented on the therapy, suggesting that it is possible to use the therapy regardless of the length of a patient's disease duration. Here's Dr. Cree with his takeaways.
So the N-Momentum clinical trial investigated the question as to whether B-cell depletion with a monoclonal antibody directed against CD19 is effective at preventing relapses and disability in neuromyelitis optica. And the study was conducted, it was a placebo-controlled trial, and was successful and showed that there was a highly significant effect of inebilizumab, also known as Uplizna, on preventing attacks and also prevention of disability worsening. There are other outcomes too, such as an impact on hospitalizations and an impact on new lesions seen in central nervous system imaging by MRI, and there were significant effects there as well. The presentation here at this meeting is addressing the question as to whether inebilizumab is different in individuals who have had a single attack, meaning newly diagnosed NMO patients, or in individuals who have had more than one attack. So these are people who have had a longer disease course. And what is being shown in the poster presented here is that inebilizumab has a very comparable effect in individuals who've had a single attack, meaning newly diagnosed individuals, compared to individuals who've had more than one attack or many attacks. And so it's important for clinicians to know and understand that inebilizumab can be used in individuals who, right at the time of first attack who are newly diagnosed, as well as in patients who have a longer disease course and almost invariably more treatment experience as well.
Now you're going to hear a little bit of what we talked to Dr. Shergill Baxi about. Baxi is the Senior Vice President of Clinical and Scientific Solutions at Verana Health, and she spoke specifically about the work that Verana is doing to help integrate data from EHRs into the AHN's Axon registry. Here's Dr. Baxi with a little bit of information about the registry and what they're hoping to achieve with it.
So the Axon Registry was actually created by the AAN, like many other professional societies, in response to CMS-mandated quality reporting. What AAN has enabled their providers who participate in Axon to do is to get access to data quality reporting. We, Verana, as the technology partner, integrates the data from the EHRs of practicing providers into the Axon registry and then enables the ease and facilitation of high quality reporting of those measures. As a provider myself, I think we've had a real love-hate relationship with electronic health records, right? I mean, it is part of our day-to-day, it's become part of medicine. What the registry is trying to do is to take all of that work that's already done entering information into the EHR and facilitate the delivery of these quality measures to CMS. Quality measure reporting to CMS is mandated. It's part of, you know, the reality of practicing medicine today. And so the number one benefit is that that burden of actually generating those numbers, those MIPS numbers to report each year is now handled by AAN through the partnership with Verana. Verana is committed to working directly with the providers to provide an ease of that integration and interactions to make sure that it is matching their expectations and quality through our dashboards that we've developed. In addition, what we do for our providers is we have a team of practice experience management specialists who will sort of engage and help providers as they navigate how to use the Verana engine really to help facilitate the ease of their reporting. But beyond participating in the Axon registry for MIPS, I think that what we're hoping to do is to show all the other potential that participation in the Axon registry can have for providers directly and then indirectly. So directly, by participating in Axon, you also get access to registry-enabled trial recruitment, right? And we can talk about that in a second, and it comes in two forms. In addition, we're hoping to show through some of the research that was presented here this week how bringing all of this information together enables really important research in neurology. And so once you have a representative database, you're actually able to study populations and diseases in ways that we previously couldn't using what we call real-world data.
We're going to close out today's episode with some of our conversation with Dr. Indu Subramanian, the director of the VA's Southwest Parkinson's Disease Research, Education, and Clinical Centers, and a clinical professor of neurology at UCLA. We spoke with her about how the field has changed since the inception of COVID-19 and how the state of burnout and mental health among providers has been affected. Here's Dr. Subramanian with her experience.
Well, I think that what I found, and I don't know how politically correct this is to state, but I think it became kind of obvious, is that I think for the first time, a few things happened. I think with COVID, you saw people break down, you know, with doctors who came out weeping and crying and doctors not having all the answers, right? We were all learning in a huge way together. So you saw the human side of doctors and really the fallibility of doctors and the sort of, you know, the sort of vulnerability of doctors in many ways. And so, you know, we became much more human, which I think is important for society to see that we're not all just perfect and, you know, super women or super men that can, you know, be, you know, on continuously and just give, right? That something's got to break if you do that. So I think we saw that. And that humanism, I think, is important. The second thing we saw, in my opinion, which is a little bit more of a awkward thing to call out, is that, you know, our lives were expendable. We didn't have PPE and people expected us to go in and take care of business. And there was really no backup plan as to what are you going to do once you, you know, have this many doctors falling sick. And we saw the guidelines constantly being changed just to support staff coming in and covering, right? So we saw, you know, an infrastructure and, you know, a system built around sort of just using the workforce as best as they could without a real regard for the safety and health sometimes of the people that you're working with. And I think as a healthcare provider, I really felt like, you know, if I don't stand up for myself and we don't stand up for ourselves, who's going to do that for us, right? We saw that. We also saw, I think, you know, the sort of sense that we can do it all and have to do it all with very little regard for backup plans. You know, many of us, luckily my children were a bit older, but I had colleagues who had babies at home, had to cover their clinics, you know, two healthcare providers in a home, sleeping in separate, you know, parts of their garage sometimes or whatever to keep each other from getting sick, and their families being sometimes shipped to grandparents to take care of just to keep the hospital running, and, you know, really without regard to, you know, the mental health of people in that sort of circumstance, really just, you know, day after day, shift after shift, and a lot of just things happening without really the ability to process what all we were going through at the time. And really, you know, I think a lot of it is traumatic, and a lot of people saw a lot of bad things happen and are still processing that, and we're still in it. So I think all of these things together, I think in my opinion, has made it, for me at least, important to be very clear about why I'm in medicine and try to align my goals of care moving forward to not just a day job that's gonna, you know, pay my bills. Because I think that there are other jobs that could be done that are safer, possibly, and, you know, may have a better infrastructure plan and don't treat necessarily their providers as dispensable, as we've seen. You know, I think something's got to give when you're homeschooling your kids and, you know, taking care of 7,000 other things that your aging parents and making sure that everyone's safe. So, and your neighbors, and, you know, many of us were just trying to keep a lot of things happening. So I do think that my alignment and my way of coping, one of the things that we brought to the women was really to be passionate about something and that know your worth in some ways. I have a very niche area. I'm interested in neurology, movement disorders, Parkinson's disease, so very subspecialized. But, you know, bringing in integrative medicine and some of these out-of-the-box approaches to that sort of niche field already, but that makes me sort of a specialist and a unique person that's very valuable, in my opinion, to, you know, the bigger picture, you know, and in the COVID timeframe when many of us couldn't really make changes of medications or change DBS or give Botox in our clinics, we had to do what we could over the phone to keep our patients, you know, well, or through Zoom. And a lot of it was, you know, try to, you know, breathe deeply, try, you know, an online yoga class, or try to call a friend, you know, or try to, you know, go out in your garden and see if you can, you know, get some sort of comfort in your rose bush's garden, you know, trimming or whatever, you know. But these are the things that we all felt comfortable with, right? Baking bread or, you know, things like that. So I think we just naturally gravitate as people, as a species, to these things that bring us comfort. And I personally think that they're, when push comes to shove and we're in those sort of desperate times, some of the things that are, in my opinion, sort of the unspoken heroes are the things that I've really been very passionate about, which include, you know, sleep, exercise, you know, social connection, eating right, you know, trying to, you know, stay sort of grounded in the mind-body sort of space and finding comfort where you can, if it's prayer, if it's meditation, if it's stillness, you know, sort of disconnecting from all the madness of the devices. So I think that these are things that, you know, the women also spoke about, you know, needing to have structure and building in time on a calendar for self-care, putting that exercise class on, putting on that happy hour on your calendar, making sure you have your days off, you know, scheduled, because if you don't put them on the calendar with our current schedules now, you know, you can have endless amounts of work that piles up and more work after that, you know, so, and full calendars for, you know, and very little to give for any of it.
Thanks for listening to this recap of the 2022 American Academy of Neurology annual meeting. Of course, we couldn't cover everything that happened over the span of the meeting this week, so if you'd like to see more from Neurology Live and hear more about what happened at the meeting, please check out neurologylive.com or the corresponding link in the show notes. Listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.